All right, so I have a brief recap of what we know, what we're doing, if you answer Massimo's questions. For him, he's gone. There's no answers.
But you asked for it. You asked for it.
That's fine.
You lost your eye.
Okay, so what are the questions? From our side, the questions, of course, go down to why are 1As so useful for cosmology? And those are physical questions. Maybe why do they behave in this sort of nicely predictable way that can be used? And that's been defined by Mark as this relation between luminosity and electric shape and many other things as well. If you understand why supernovae behave the way they do, we can possibly ask the question of, you know, how do they actually explode? Do they have a single explosion mode? Do they have more than one? Where do they actually come from? The way we do that, as always, this was no change in the way looking at spectrum and light, because that's all we've got. So, what are the things we're looking at? Of course, the Phillips relation is number one. This goes back to his original plot. And the B-band is a place that's particularly interesting, where the luminosity is most sensitive to the current wave. I'm going to repeat that. Later on, it was established by the work of Leibowitz and Bertolt and Tyler, that's easier, that the same relation between peak brightness and width of a light curve also applies if you compute volumetric light curves. This is not an easy exercise because you need to rely on A, beta, B, and known corrections to the beta. But if you do those things, you know, to the best of your abilities, we can recover a relation where the brightest supernovae also have a lower light curve. So that now must be a physical effect, it's not just your passive that is causing it. So that's quite interesting. It actually allows us to look more into the problem physics of the problem. Another relation that myself and others put out years ago is between the width of the iron emission lines in the nebula phase, which is about a year after the explosion, and the same luminosity given here, parameterizing as delta 15. The idea here being that the brightest supernovae with the smallest decline rate have the broadest iron emission lines. And that is supposed to be an indication of the fact that there is indeed more iron, and that means there was more nickel 56 out of the explosion. And you see that by just having more volume filled by iron at later times. The relation is there, there's only a few objects because it's so easy to get nebula spectra. It's of course nowhere near as good as the early time relation, but there is some sort of trend. More convincing, I'd agree, if you look at the spectra themselves with the relations. So, how does this all come together? Well, one attempt by people by Stephen Benetti and others from a group in Padawan, neighboring places, is to reclassify 1As, and one idea that Stefan had was to look at the development of the silicon 2 line, which is the strongest B line, and to look at the development of the velocity of that over time. And he came up with this classification scheme where he's divided things into, you know, line 3, colors red, blue, green, where the blue supernovae show a high gradient of the velocity in the pre-maximum phase. The green supernovae shows a not a lower gradient, but they are otherwise very similar to the spectrum. And the red supernovae, which basically group all those that are faint. So the 91 region is the lower end of the normal, and so on, all fall in that group. What is nice about that division is that once you plot the silicon velocity versus delta 15, you get a nice separation of three groups that show almost no overlap. So that must be telling us something, we have no idea what.
I understand in the top plot, the red and green and blue, they show some overlap.
Yeah, because the actual velocities aren't completely separate, but this is the dot. So the gradient separates and the actual values go not as much, except that the red supernovae have, on average, lower velocities than the blue. And the blue ones start higher.
But can I understand how was decided to draw a line between the green and the blue at any particular V-dot? It just looks like arbitrary.
Yeah, choice. Completely arbitrary.
There's no other indicator?
No, except that know, you don't want to call that blue, but you don't want to call this green.
But you did some sort of a principal component analysis.
Yes, some sort of you see these groups, you have columns. You could argue about the color of these, but that's more or less.
There are other parameters entering into this principal component analysis.
Is there a date on that v-dot, or is it a time phase? Or
this is over the pre-maximum phase. All right, so what do? We do, of course, radiation transfer. We simulate supernova spectrum in the early phase. And what we're using here, Dan's going to talk more about methods tomorrow, is an anti-carbon code, which has been around. And we've used it for many objects. This is one. The picture's not very nice. This is O2BO, one of the RTA supernovae. And the idea that we've had was, with the RTN a few years ago, that if we could collect a very large number of spectra with very small time span between, we might have a chance to see the abundances as they unfold in the ejecta. So as we look deeper and deeper into the ejecta, the surface abundances will change. We can explore those abundances via synthetic spectra. And hopefully see how the abundances change as a function of velocity, because really what is changing as time goes on is the velocity layer for which you're looking. Now this is a very simple approximation, but in essence that's what we're doing. So for this particular object and others, so this is the one that we actually done the most work for, we got spectra about every night, and by reproducing these spectra to the best of our model's ability, which of course has problems, but it has more good things than it has problems, I think, and one good thing is that it is very quick. So we can almost compute spectra as fast as the observers can produce them from the sky, which is becoming a problem these days for us. We then have to wait, sorry for the jump in topics here, but we look at the early phase with those spectra, and we then wait for about a year and go back to the nebula phase, which we discussed earlier. And the advantage of the nebula phase is that we don't have radiation transfer problems, everything is fully transparent, and by looking at line profiles, we can more or less derive the abundances as a function of velocity, because these are nebula emission paths, so you're not now very fast. So by combining an early time study with a late time study like one spectrum like this, we can more or less get the distribution of abundances throughout the ejector from higher velocities on the outside to the lowest velocities in the part, which is what we're treating in the spectrum. Of course, just to remind you, the early spectra dominated by the medium mass elements such as silicon, sulfur, some iron. These spectra here are completely dominated by iron ones, so we are looking at different parts of supernovae.
In the unobserved part of the spectrum, is that calcium or is that also iron and nickel?
This is both. It's iron and calcium and carbon, so lots of things. We have spectra located where this region appears to be all the ones that this time.
When you mentioned earlier the relationship between the width of the iron ones and delta 15, did you, in order to compute the nickel mass, did you use any of these nebular transfer code, or did you just measure the velocities?
The mass is always coming from calculation.
Because it could be, you know, the width could be just velocity affected.
All right, so this is what we get in this particular case. It's a bit of a crowded plot, but there are color codings in this here, so you can see what is going on. The silicon is a yellow line, and we find it is distributed way down into the ejector. The nickel is the red line here, which you see in the model, like W7. This is by... by mass, and the other one is by number, I think. So anyway, the nickel is located here, essentially. There is a very small unburnt region in the prediction. This is again W7, which we're using as our Bible, basically. And we don't see much or any at all in the ejector, which means we may not have early enough data, which also may mean there is no current. There is oxygen, and we can see a bit of oxygen, but we don't see any oxygen down deep, otherwise we expect our nebula spectra. So this is the sort of game we're playing. And at the end of this, you find another distribution that is not too different from that of a typical explosion model such as
this. Sorry, Paolo, when you do this kind of modeling, do you assume something for the structure of the ejector? in order to do the calculations?
And
for the density structure.
For the density structure. This is the only thing we have assumed, but it has to be said that you can look at most models and below, let's say, 12,000 kilometers per second.
Or less. One should say, though, that in W7, the data that you show here for W7, were managed to reproduce spectra.
The abundance,
the mixing was
the abundance.
No, the abundances you get are kind of absolutely tweak to get the spectra. Now you get the spectra and there you get consistency.
Yes.
It's not a surprise.
That's not a surprise. The question here was the density structure is what counts for hydrocarburation. That is valid.
Again, not quite, because the velocity of the deflagration front was put
in. It was shared.
This is, yes, this was the structure.
This was true. It is, however, true that on the other hand, if you just let the exposure go, you don't actually generate the same sort of density, the same energies.
But so when you get that energy, keep in mind the W7 was tweaked in order to fit data.
Yeah, sure. Anyway, that doesn't work. So I think the challenge, in a sense, is to try and get something that looks as nice when you put it in a 1D context, of course.
Well, if you say something about how unique this inversion is, it seems to me that it must be very difficult to go backwards from the spectra to this interior
context. It's actually not easy.
Well, there you are.
On the other hand, the fact that it's not easy doesn't mean it's not unique, because mm-hmm. each element can affect each other, can affect every other element by, you know, changing the opacities and so on. But most of the opacities are due to ion lines, and the presence of, let's say, elements such as silicon and sulfur does not really affect the overall opacity, so it's fairly easy to fix the abundances of those. The calcium is a low abundance thing. And the level of interplay that you may expect is not as high as if you're just weathering with blind opacities, because the places where the lines affect each other, the elements affect each other, it's not probably so. So you can actually isolate the silicon, which is very nicely. You can isolate the iron by looking at the iron 2 to iron 3 ratios and do well. So there are tricks that you can use.
I would like to be sure that I understood what Wolfgang said. Did you say that models are produced in order to fit the data, and then these models are used back to...
Well, not quite. So I was just saying that the agreement, W7, should not come as a surprise.
W7 was...
W7, okay.
The only thing that really enters into this tomography business here is that you have to invoke some density structure to map, say, from velocity space onto mass scale. And so this is done here, so you put in the mass, but if you would leave just the velocity, and
plot, I mean, if you had a model,
then you would not even need the density.
You would not need the density to your density, to your abundances, because you would never have absorption at sufficiently high velocities, for instance.
But in one of those days, I will show was the result of failing up initio model and compared to DO.
That's where
you can start to learn a little bit where the failures of the up initio models are still present and where we have to work hard to get rid of those. But anyhow, so in principle, I can use that as a very powerful tool to compare models with observations.
Paolo, how does the bottom panel compare to MPA's 3D deflagrations?
I'm sure that one of those days.
Okay. Radically different, or I mean,
well, I think some the calculations don't work out.
The Kina 1.2 solar masses are almost in perfect agreement with BO. The outer layers are not.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you make some assumption about? I mean, you can't tell the different isotopes of iron. So, how can you
at
tell?
At this phase, we are actually in a privileged position, because if you go back to these, now the efforts of these are minus 12 to minus 4. Mm. Now there's no way you can have a lot of iron 56 with those efforts, because it just doesn't have the time to decay from the coefficient on decay time. So most of the iron you're looking at here in these features must have been of whatever isotope in the state.
But you're looking fairly high in the atmosphere,
nice,
but
yeah.
If you go deeper, well, you notice you had a difference between iron and nickel in the inner parts.
This is something I'm going to come to in a minute. At these times, you don't really have a problem because, as I say, you're looking at nickel, which you can't see because of the thermal lines. It just does a luminosity for you. You're looking at cobalt, which has some lines. And all the iron you see must be almost all of it stable. 56, 54, whatever. Later on, at this phase, what you're looking at is mostly iron, and at 300 days I would agree that all the iron, the nickel 56 has basically decayed, most of it has decayed into iron, but you're looking at two lines which are mostly iron 3 and mostly iron 2. Okay, so I'll repeat that a little later, but to determine the ionization balance, that requires knowing both the heating and the cooling. And the iron 56 that comes from the nickel 56 gives you heating, and then that iron 56 gives you cooling as well. The stable iron gives you cooling by your lines, but it doesn't give you heating because it hasn't been formed by your reactor decay. And so getting that ionization balance correct means you've got the heating and the cooling properly accounted for.
So yeah, this is hard.
It's hard, but it works. All right. You see how nicely this works. Right. This is a little test that we did of computing in Monte Carlo again, a light curve where, it's a bit hard to see, but you take the original W7 model, you compute the light curve with the red feature, which fits the peak reasonably well, but it rises much too late. And why does it rise too late? Because there's no meeting out of nickel 56. Once you adopt the abundances from the early time spectrum, which is what you mean for the Hertz velocities, and you replace those into the abundances of your light curve, so the original W7 abundances, you have mixed out some nickel, and your rising part of the light curve is earlier, and it fits the observations. There was no tweaking down here, which is took what came from the spectrum, put it in this equation. So that's a sign that we're doing something useful, at least, I think. And so how can you try and put all this together? What we've done is taken a number of supernovae for which we have both early time and late time spectrum. So for which we could play this entire game from the beginning to the end and determine abundances at all points. The first thing we did is looking at nebula spectra, basically to reproduce that plot of delta fusion versus velocity of the iron emission. And with more supernovae, the trend is still there. Now we've got a color coding in there, which doesn't really matter. But the trend has a big dispersion, but it is there.
So this is the velocity width of the iron line.
The iron line is the length. So it's the same as the black and white plot I had earlier on with velocity in the emissions. This is a plot of the mass of nickel 56 from the model of the time spectra versus the decline rate. And again, there is a nice correlation, as expected. More deviation in the blue objects than in the green ones, but the correlation is there. So that's good. Roll the stable iron elements. So I'm trying to go over what I just said before. The stable iron isotopes do not heat the gas, they radiate in line, so they cool the gas. That's the big take home. And so by trying to establish the balance of iron 2 to iron 3, you have to introduce some stable iron 54 and 58 in the abundances. And these are at very low velocities. So we're talking about the velocities that are below 10,000 kilometers per second that contribute to the rate and the spec. What you see here is a plot that has, well, some degree of uncorrelation in the green objects, but overall not any great significant trend. Alright? That's perhaps not unexpected. What is, or was to us at least, unexpected is what comes up next. If you now plot versus delta M15, so that's still the same as before, not just the nickel 56 on the y-axis, but the total MSC material, so the sum of the 56 nickel and the stable iron. What you get is a relation, you may not believe this because it comes from something like this to what we had before, but what you get is a relation that is actually tighter that the one between the negatives and that time. This also came as a surprise. It works quite nicely. The blue objects are the ones that are fun. This one in particular, you might ask, it has a late time spectrum that is in complete contradiction with the early time luminosity. It has very narrow lines, but it's supposed to be very, very bright. And if anybody had early time spectral cases, it's quite interesting to look for that.
I'm sorry, isn't this curve the same as the curve, the velocity width of the iron line at late times?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, isn't this the same plot?
This is mass of MC.
I understand. Go back, though.
Yes. It's very similar. And this is mass of 56.
No, but you had a velocity width. I'm looking at the data
that's
on the left. That's the velocity width of the iron.
Everything.
Right. All I'm saying is, isn't that plot now just interpreted as
it's
mass,
similar, but the mixing is not 100%. So this would be correct if you assume that only iron group material was present below that velocity. You could translate that directly into a mass. You would have abundances as well, because not all of that is MC material. So. Now, how do we combine that with what sits above that inner iron layer? We can do it by comparing velocities, and this gets a bit complicated, but the dots are, as you just said, the outer iron velocities, and the circles, the empty sort of circles, are the inner velocity of the silicon as derived from the evolution of the early time spectrum. So at some point you expected the composition to go from silicon dominated to iron dominated, and the agreement between those velocities is actually quite good. If you do a formal fit of this, it's consistent with zero. So we do see a transition, well, big surprise. But then you can also look at the outer distribution of the silicon by looking at where is the highest velocity of the silicon is detected at. And perhaps surprisingly, what came out is that this is not correlated with delta 15 at all. The outer velocity of the silicon is about constant in all type 1As, regardless of luminosity. There are some exceptions. These are surprisingly the blues, but this has nothing to do with the luminosity. Okay? So it doesn't really affect anything you do calibration. And understanding that may be interesting, but the bulk of the objects, including the faint ones, show roughly a constant velocity. And because the time there is also fairly constant, you can, this is possibly the weakest argument, the weakest statement argument, use the same density structure for all of these and derive that the mass is constant. You may say, well, but these may be subtriangular, they may be, but then again, how would you have opacity at these high velocities in your This block convinced me, at least, that the masses must not be very different from the very bright to the very thin. And that's interesting. So, let's put it all together in what I call the Jorah diagram, because I'm just like the shape of that. And we do it by layer by layer. So at the bottom, at the lowest velocity, it's also going to have a fairly constant amount of stable iron group elements, iron 54, iron 58. Adding on top of that is the iron 56, which of course gives you this trend with luminosity, where the brightest supernova you have more, and the faintest are only about 0.17 masses. Fairly large distribution, fairly large scatter about that distribution. So, why is that? And this derivation of the masses should be fairly large, depending, of course, on the distance and the sequence as well. You combine those two, you get narrower scatter for the sum of the MSC material. And then you put the silicon outer velocity, which more or less gives you the extent of the burning in the black hole. Right? And you find that this is okay. So what you can learn from that is that there has been burning to MC material for a certain fraction of the star, there's been burning to the medium mass elements for a different fraction. These two are reasonably anti-correlated, however. And so because the kinetic energy yield of the burning does not really depend very much on whether you burn to MC or to the medium mass elements, you get roughly the same kinetic energy for every explosion, regardless of its brightness, its luminosity. Interesting names. So I've just said that. And the question is what all this means. And of course we put related to mention because in standard deflagration you expect to make roughly a constant mass shell of intermediate mass burning because it starts pre-expands during the burning and you can only burn so much into intermediate mass elements before the density gets too low. Detonating the thing at some point makes it easier for the burning to proceed regardless of how much it starts pre-expanding because it's not supersonic, you just burn the rest of the stuff. So this is a possible mechanism. There are other possibilities such as multispotic matter deflagrations and so on. Of course, we don't know how the late deformation actually starts, but it may be something we'll discover, or they will discover, or someone else. But there may be other possibilities, but what this all seems to point to is that the supernova, more or less, the star knows how to explode, and it seems to make a similar amount of kinetic energy regardless of the amount of the physics that it's produced.
And what is that number, that constant?
Kinetic energy is about 1.25 times 10^32. That's what you're expecting to do. Okay, so just to go over this again, we've tried to then understand the behavior of the light curve based on these properties. And this goes back to the OW7 plot and tries to show where things are made. And I'm just repeating this again. The little 56 makes light, it makes opacity because these are elements with very, very dense atomic level diagrams, many spectrum lines, which is the opacity, which is quasi integration, but it's essentially line opacity. And so elements with lots of lines are much more effective than elements with few lines. And making 56 nickel gives you kinetic energy. That's just the property of the burn. The stable iron gives you opacity, gives you kinetic energy. It doesn't give you light, of course. The intermediate mass elements, so silicon, sulfur, calcium, give you kinetic energy almost as much as burning to NC. They only give you a bit of opacity because these atoms, these ions, do not have many spectral lines. So that contribution to the opacity is really small. The carbon oxygen, if you've got any left, could at most give you a bit of opacity. That's all. So you may just as well ignore that. Okay, so using these properties, we have in the past tried to reproduce the Phillips relation in a sort of empirical way by producing simple models where you have stable, radioactive, intermediate mass elements and compute the opacity accordingly and produce volumetric light curves that more or less replicate also a volumetric trend, mainly bright and broad. And the reason for that is that brighter means more nickel means more opacity. More opacity means a broader light curve. This goes back to work that was 10 years ago.
But the puzzle, I mean, the last time we were talking about the rise to the light, the peak, the time of peak light, which is also a breadth sort of measurement, right? So can you tell us why, 91 BG like, which has very little opacity in the surface layers, would have the same time to the peak?
It doesn't. It peaks early. Marginally, but it peaks early.
Why is that only one day out of 20? Whereas so what I don't understand is why it's only one day out of 20, but the decay time is much faster.
Well, this is the thing I don't understand. Up to 3 days in the rise time in these models. Okay, so you go from about 19 here to 17.
Right, but what I'm saying is that in the delta M15 is a much larger.
There is, well, things aren't exactly symmetric. Very early on, the density wins, so photons can't escape.
Let me ask you a different question. Do you have a different density profile for these models?
It's all the same.
Rho is a function of these? All the same.
Kinetic energy is supposed to be the same.
And the same rho is a function of V.
Yes. And so you have a dead time early on where photons just cannot escape. And that basically has to be added to this symmetric thing, which is centered about mass. On the other hand, at the late phases, these things get thin more rapidly than those. And so that's why they decline more. But the relation is that the later peak is a brighter peak. Although this is not what intuition would tell you, because the later peak is there has been more decay of the 56. But the interplay between the opacity and the liquid 56 mass is such that a later peak is a brighter here reality.
Isn't it just a statement of the stretch relation that is working also for BG?
Yes.
So if you stretch, if the stretch works also for BG, at least in the blue bands, it means there's no problem with the rice matter.
Look, we're trying to do physics, right? The stretch is
no. No, no.
The stretch is purely empirical.
No. What I was saying is that that the fact that stretch works means that there is no problem with this, you know, the rise time relative to the decay time, that they behave in a consistent method.
Right. And it still remains to be understood.
But I think we don't know the rise times for really fast decliners very at the early.
We don't. This is just a prediction. The prediction is that these things must have a shorter rise time. Mm-hmm.
Well, okay, so that's good. So I think it would be good, right, if we could write down a few predictions that people are willing to put their hands down on the chopping block for.
Absolutely.
So if the confidence is there, it would be interesting to know what that prediction is.
The nickel is asymmetrically distributed in your star, and this relationship between rise time and peak may pass away.
Because it all depends on how far this is from the surface.
And so an asymmetric distribution of nickel can completely compensate for that.
So it is interesting to see if we may be a little surprised. I mean, if I understand, at what point do you say, oh, this is odd?
Well, I would say that if we found the relation, once we have enough supernovae, we discovered very early. If we found a relation that does not behave that way, I would be very surprised. Uh-huh. And the conclusion would be that asymmetric supernovae dominate the sample, then we may as well go home.
And actually, one would then also have to look. One would then also
but they don't dominate the sample.
One would also have to look at the colors, and there's a different relationship again for your symmetric ones and for the asymmetric ones as far as the colors are concerned. So in principle, I could have different observations that would help you to kind of distinguish between the different possibilities.
But they don't dominate this. The sample is nice. The sample says bright is late.
So, just one last question about this from an observer point of view, just a second. So, would you say that it's very interesting for this sort of physical, like last for the physical question, to have a large sample of, or to construct an observational program that would produce a large sample of very early light?
We have this side of the dividing line. It's the tax that we convinced that more data is useful. But
let's say you have a freedom to invest a certain basket of observational resources. So how is it? Is getting a fewer supernovae but with excellent rise times?
If you give
more
me 20
than
supernovae of all declining lights discovered from what is the earliest possible day. You know, but
minus 19
would improve immensely.
Yeah,
you know.
We have minus 15.
So. But is there one? Let's say we have a couple. See if we could have a good.
I think you say yes.
I hear him say yes.
I don't think so. I don't think this is going to be diagnostic enough.
Why not?
Because you're going to measure in some real bands, and the transformation from energy to color has to be done properly, and they don't know how to do that well enough.
That's
the uncertainty in doing that will be bigger than the uncertainty in the underlying physics. That's what I'm
saying. No, but I'm trying to understand why is it that the filter is the beginning.
This is exactly the question. Do you want 20 early ones or 200? You know, wait, they might.
Since we started from like 3, I'd be having this 20.
Yeah, but the question is not.
We have. There is something. Yeah. And I think, Bob's got a point, but on the other hand, to see the supernova at all is a sign that it has exploded. So you see it in any band, and it has, it's there, right? I mean.
But if you had a 91 BG that took 17 days to rise up, and you could observe that versus 12 days or 10 days to rise up, that would tell you a lot.
Absolutely. Yes.
So where we have pan stars, for example, and people are observing, you know, large portions of the sky frequently enough.
Well, they're not going to be for any one, but they're going to be lucky because they're doing such a large portion of the sky.
You might get something where every once in a while, you know, it doesn't. Well, this is the question we should discuss. We want to do 20 square degrees every night or 400 square degrees once every 20 days.
This is the question. Exactly. So the one of them you'll get 200 supernovae, but they will be somewhere between day zero and minus 20. And the other option, you'll get only 20 supernovae, but all of them will be caught day one. And the question is, what will give you more physics? You know, the 400 ones will probably provide a better calibration data set for cosmology. Okay, agree. But let's think about it. My question is about the physics. Which will be more valid?
Supernovae. We have type 1A at peak that we know a lot, and we have to understand a lot about those still. But what we don't know are issues such as
catch them before they explode.
All right, so just to recap things and how we go about reproducing synthetic light curves, because I think this is interesting as well. These are the four very simple equations that are used in this recipe. And of these four equations, two are respectable because they come from respectable people. So this one is, you know, a mass relation between light curves with and various properties such as the ejected mass, the kinetic energy, and the opacity. So that's a respectable relation. Another respectable relation is this one, which is the kinetic energy yield. This comes from Stan Woosley and, of course, the other people as well. And then there are two much less respectable relations, one between the nickel 56 yield and the luminosity. This actually comes from an acceptance of mass, which they must be not respectable. And the bottom one, I'm not even going to mention, this is my own, it's a very simple approximation linking the abundances to the opacity. If you plug all that in, you can actually solve for everything and compute synthetic light curves that actually reproduce the distribution of the field's relation. And what we see is here, this is a W15 observed to be supernovae, and this is a synthetic W15, so that agrees with you well. And here is trying to compute the field's relation, so luminosity versus light curve. For the objects in the sample. The two lines, I did not do this, you know, on purpose. One is the fit to the point, and the other one is the latest version of the field observation. I'm moving the tau in a line. And they actually agree very nicely. So my message from that is the simple approximations to the opacity and so on actually work quite nicely. So it must mean something. They must mean that the abundances are actually what determined primarily what the passing.
95 AL on there?
95 AL is not there because we don't have any time spectrum. It would be very nice.
I was afraid because it fell off the
plot. No, it would.
And something like 2002 CX, which is also way. It's off, I'm sorry, 2002 CX.
Oh, 2002 CX? No, it's
on the filter relation.
Yeah, no, that's not at all. Oh,
2000 CX. Right,
2002 CX.
And what, why is that, by the way?
Oh, it just depends on data availability. We just put in whatever we have data for.
Nothing. But you know it on this plot, you just can't make a theory for it.
Well, I mean, it's not in that plot.
I can put it on the filter relation, which means I can put
you
it on the plot.
You can, yes, but you know, that, in that, when you're doing that, you're re-deriving the same relation again, so there's no point in doing that. It's on the filter relation because...
No, it's not.
O2CX is not,
it's not on the filter relation. Yeah. That's what I'm saying.
But we don't have the late-time spectrum, so I can't get it within the mass here. The same applies for this super bright supernova, you know, this super channel second mass. It'd be great to have a late-time spectrum for that. To have an independent estimate of the nickel mass. Because it may not be as large as has been claimed. It may be bigger than half.
We have to put a paper on that on the edge today.
So, you know, whatever gets added on, whatever we get data for, will be added on to this. And I'm not sure there's something for off the plot. That'd be interesting. Okay. Here is mostly for Frank, I think. This is going back to the nickel 54, and how this can affect what we see. There's other ways of involvement, but to mention how asymmetries can affect the distribution in greenhouse gas cycle as well. But, doing the same exercise we did before, but now changing the stable iron in the same region toward middle 56. Since making those assumptions means, obviously, the opacity will change, but the luminosity will change when the opacity warms. And so what you see is a family, which shares a family of micros, which share the shape in those color-coded, but not the same peak brightness, because the amount of nickel 56 has now changed the neutral brightness. And so you could, if that effect is real, if you can get a different ratio of 56 to stable, you may be fooled into, by just using the light curve, deriving the incorrect, possibly incorrect, average, according to whatever, not necessarily the correct luminosity for that particular supernova we're looking at, because there may be a spread depending on how much stable NSC material there is mixed into the radioactive material. And the effect of that may be as large as 0.2 magnitudes about the mean relation. So this may be something to look at.
That's what we have already.
That's what we did.
But that's what Frank was trying to explain anyway. So.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And there's no relation with the chemistry of the galaxies.
There seems to be. Sorry. The effects should be there physically. If it doesn't,
you'd expect that this would max out at some point where you can't produce more nickel than you had the white dwarf, but it could go lower. So there's...
Well, that's exactly what we've done. So we started with the highest 10. We can only take it down.
Right, but you only stopped it because you only wanted to explain it.
Well, you could go to the extreme of making no 56 and you can't go supernova at all. I mean, whether this would be physically meaningful...
Why don't we see these?
Yeah,
well,
you
should
search for those.
Yes, those very faint ones. Okay. So it's just a caveat. And yeah, this may actually have potential effects on our understanding of cosmology. If there is a trend with metallicity such that the average luminosity of the supernova changes with whatever, maybe the chemistry, maybe the energy, maybe just not be there at all. I know about your way. It may not be. And so, you know, but if it was there, it may have an effect, maybe that we could. We may not be able to measure certain parameters very, very accurately.
What if you test this against the evidence from the high redshift supernova, which we already have, where we see the sign of the effect changing? I can't quite read these plots to understand.
Well, this just tells you that if you have a certain evolution of the metallicity with age, you may have, if you assume that the 1A's behave like we said before, you may have an evolution of the luminosity such that you may get, let's say, this kind of cosmology look like what you're looking at. What you interpret as lambda may be compatible with lambda of 0 and not gamma of 0.3. Assuming a certain extreme change of the 1A is looking at this. This is all sort of theoretical. All right. I think just one more, but this is going even more into
change sign. Has it changed sign between redshift of a half and redshift 1.5?
It should change sign.
I don't think any explanation of that character can be right because the effect changes sign. I mean, what we see is, a little brighter.
The actual measurement of the amount may be affected by the spread.
Well, yes. Okay.
The
sign change is relative to the zero unit. This is, goes back to what you guys used to plot it.
Relative to
the empty universe with nothing in it, sign. Silly.
Hey,
seriously. I'm just showing you again.
But how many of the high C's
the highest?
Everybody's like, well, there's only one highest, but there are 23 higher than redshift 1.
Okay, gotcha.
All right, so I don't have to go through the conclusions again. They're just there. We can refer them before. So that's it. Thanks very much. Thank you.
I'd just like to make a comment. Last week I showed models for type of supernova remnant. If you look at the supernova remnant data and don't do any modeling, for Tycho and Kepler, and for the three supernova remnants that Tom has mentioned, 0509, 0519, and 103b, in all of those, the ionization state of silicon is higher than the ionization state of iron, which is telling you that most of the silicon must be ahead of most of the iron in the structure of the ejecta. Again, the information content of the conclusion is exactly zero in view of what of the results that you have showed. But it's nice to see that it comes from a completely independent look at things. Then of course, there's SN1006 where you see silicon, you don't see practically no iron.
Right. There may be some of those in that plot, those that aren't very bright. They should have a lot of silicon, not very much.
No. They have to have another explanation of why the high iron is hidden, not yet seen.
If there is
another story.
And you know, 1006
wasn't really bright.
1006 wasn't that voluminous.
Well, there's plenty of voluminous.
Yeah, you know, from the Chinese records,
it wasn't. Yeah, they could read a newspaper by daylight.
The reason why you don't see iron in the X-rays is that the dynamic age of remnant is very young, and the reverse shock has really not processed much in the
computer. Okay, but that's a different story.
But you're talking about the absorption in the...
Well, both.
So, but I mean, there should be, if this is correct, there should be the 91 BG remnants where you should see a lot of silicon and not very much iron. Yeah. One question of being very bright people.